disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to
the Beatles, and that was the last number one hit that was from Let It Be, but it was probably recorded during the Abbey Road Let It Be period,
and it was knocked out of the number one spot by the Jackson 5.
Is that true?
No, yeah. That's okay. May of 1970.
The Beatles, The Long and Winding Road. I have Candy Leonard, the author of Beatleness, with me, and Prudence is with me.
Hi, everybody.
You can find Beatleness, it's a book by Candy Leonard, at your local bookstore. You could also order it online. Do you want to give out a website, or
if you want to find out a little more about the book, you can go to beatleness.com, which is the book website, and there are some excerpts, some reviews, some videos of me talking about it, and kind of an overview if you want to get a feel for what the book is about. And it's available everywhere. Books are sold. Amazon, of course, seems to be where people buy books these days.
Yeah.
But I do know for a fact there are three, as of this moment, I think, at least there were the other day, at Porter Square Books.
And if you want to have Candy do a lecture at your local school or university, contact her, and
you can write
she can talk about Beatles.
Candy at beatleness.com, And yeah, I can come out to your school. And also, you know, even like with young kids, like I actually got I get a lot of emails from people who've read the book, and the youngest person I got like from a 12-year-old in California who
That's
read
great.
The book. And it was really very, very gratifying. So yeah, I'm happy to come and talk to people of all ages.
The book is all about the Beatles and the fans' eye view of the Beatles. And Prudence was talking a little bit about how when the Beatles were in a room and they left, the energy was taken away.
Yes.
And they say Elvis was a bit like that. When he was there on stage, when he was giving a performance, the room, the auditorium, the theater was... You know, the only place in the world to be.
Yeah, there was electricity that people could feel. But this, I'm talking about the Beatles even off stage, just in a room, at least at the beginning.
I don't know about Elvis off stage. What do you think?
He was very humble, and he had very low self-esteem. It was a great two-volume biography. But Candy talks about the kind of mystical aspect in the book Beatleness.
Well, at the end, because we were, when off the air just now, we were talking about this kind of this magical thing. You know, it's a word that people often use to describe just the whole phenomenon.
Yes.
Like, how did this thing happen? You know, and as I'm a sociologist, right? So I approach this as a social scientist. Now, I don't want to take the magic out of it.
Oh, please don't.
But I kind of look at the magic and listen to other people talking about the magic, and there is this sense of, certainly for baby boomers, how blessed we were to witness this growing up and to experience this, and just the unlikeliness of their story, the serendipity, the moments where, well, what if this hadn't happened? What if, you know, certain connections hadn't been made or certain opportunities hadn't presented themselves? So there is an unlikely, there's a weirdness as this, back when Jan Wenner reviewed the Hunter Davies book back in 68 in Rolling Stone, and he said, nobody talked, and this was in 68, he said, nobody talks about the weirdness of this whole thing. And that's kind of what I do in the book, is that, you know, I sort of look at it as a phenomenon from a sociological perspective. But getting back to the magic, the final chapter, I have a section called The Beatles and the Cosmos, because there is this feeling that of the sense of wonder and magic. And how did this happen?
Right.
And how did these four guys come to find each other in Liverpool, of all places? And so, and the fact that they are still so loved by so many millions and millions of people all over the world, and people, teach their children about the Beatles and teach their grandchildren about the Beatles. And it's a, it has a almost a religion-like quality to
and
it.
And at the time, when you heard something along the lines of this, it must have been pretty stunning for the first time.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Well, that wasn't bad.
That was stunning.
This was stunning, but this is not what I wanted to play. And what I... One second.
Okay.
In case you don't know the song, it's called...
Love, Love Me Do.
Love, Love Me Do. And that great harmonica there.
Yeah.
That was a song that is a blues harmonica, and that was kind
of taught
special.
John Lennon learned to play the harmonica. He's got a few lessons from Delbert McClinton.
Yes.
Yeah, and he was
very good, Ken.
And that song
I wrote a book about the Beatles.
What was
it
called? What's that book called?
Beatleness. And
don't Beatlesplain me.
Love Me Do was a significant hit. I didn't realize that it was such a significant hit in Britain, but it really was. It stayed in the charts a long time.
Yes, it did.
And then Please Please Me became a number one song. And that song carried the whole harmonica sound. So it's kind of interesting how Love Me Do had that at first, and then it went into Please Please Me.
Yeah.
Then a few years later, and this is what I actually wanted to play, folks, I don't mind telling you, you heard this. It was like, what the heck is this? This is kind of different in many, many ways. Check out this. What were you doing when you heard this for the first time?
Thank you.
picture yourself on a boat on a river and listen, picture yourself listening to this song. And wow, talk about the beginnings of world beat, world pop.
World music, absolutely. They definitely introduced world music to the west.
And talk about Liverpool Scouse
yes.
leading you through India.
That. I love that.
I adore it.
Within You Without You Too is one of my top Beatles songs.
Without a doubt.
I prefer this song to Within You. I'm not crazy about it. It's too slow. It drags. It really does.
I think Pepper needed a song like that. I think Pepper had She's Leaving Home, which is a beautiful slow song. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of a bouncy rocking album. I think he needed something like Within or Without You for a little some gravitas, you know.
Well,
hard to do.
It's pretty amazing. I think George Martin
all day long make love singing songs.
Well, this is another
multitasking.
I think George Martin had his hands full with this one because it sounds like a little bit of a Beatle electric guitar there thrown in with
headphones. You can hear all sort of the Beatles from Rubber Soul on. If you have headphones on, you hear all these little.
Check this out.
Absolutely,
that's wonderful.
It's a celebration.
People standing around and screw you in the ground.
No, this is why this song and Revolve, you know, you start to get the emergence of the hippie ethos
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
And so this is a celebration of a new way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's about love. It's about who you are, mm-hmm. self-expression. Don't label me mm-hmm. on me. You know, in other words, this self-assertion mm-hmm. of especially for young people,
mm.
and love and self-expression was a big part of the self-identity, mm-hmm. authenticity.
Be who you are.
Be who you are.
And for the Beatles themselves to take a chance and put this on Revolver is really significant because up until this point, I don't think there's any Beatles song half as odd/foreign or exotic as that song. I think George had in 50 years ago, folks, 1966.
Yeah, exactly.
George had, you know, he's a very bold person to present this idea, this song to the Beatles. And
well,
guess what? He got the green light, and I'm very grateful he did.
Revolver, three songs from which.
No, but this song in particular, mm-hmm. though, I want to tell you in Taxman, they have Beatle overtones to them.
Right,
but this song, no way.
It's a George song.
Extremely
it's
extremely different.
Sui generis.
Yeah. And yet, it fits into the album, and it's glorious. I mean, I absolutely adore it.
Yeah.
So we're talking Beatleness with Candy Leonard. Call 617-627-3800 if you have a question or if you want to order a copy of the book. This is
really
not selling.
This is Freeform Radio.
What's that phone number again?
Tufts University Freeform Radio 617-627-3800. That is the number to call.
See, now Freeform Radio, that was a thing that did not exist. 1966.
50 years ago. Right.
It wasn't until really late 67 that we started hearing, you know, that there was a little bit of FM happening where you could hear these mm-hmm. deeper cuts and something other than top 40 with the high energy. So suddenly we have this
mellow guy.
Exactly.
Listen to the 17-minute version of You Keep Me Hanging On.
Right. Well, because pop music, because of the Beatles, had become, it was a renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
and there was so much great music, and it couldn't, you know, I mean, AM radio, just you couldn't hear it. Of course, there was, you know, there were also, of course, economic interests in FM, and stations had to, there were rulings about what they could and couldn't do. Anyway, but there was this proliferation
mm-hmm.
starting in late 67 of freeform radio.
Right, and the technology of stereo becoming,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, the Beatles played Shea Stadium. Can you imagine that?
Named after the Cuban revolutionary Shea Stadium. It's a Ruddles reference for all you.
And Let It Rot is it?
All you need is cash.
Oh, yeah, there you go. But I mean, saying the Beatles played Shea Stadium, it's pretty amazing to think about these four people from Liverpool 6 years earlier could not get to Scotland. Well, they could not. They couldn't. Have people in a bar. Really. Right. Six, seven years earlier, they were playing to. A church fair, basically. Well,
that's another thing we're talking about, audiences. This magic. How did these guys, there's some great quotes of, there were actually back then, Candy, you probably can tell, there were people who actually didn't like the Beatles.
Oh,
and
sure.
Considered them communist infiltrators, and one of this pamphlet about the Beatles and communism in Russia mentions how else could the Beatles, who are musically illiterate, come up with all these new sounds, but that they were an experiment by the Soviet Union. and we laugh, but those people are voting today for a certain subject.
Yeah,
but
no,
anyway, I'm sorry.
Well, the Beatles, to pick up on what you're saying, the Beatles really, people talk about, I want my country back, or Make America Great Again.
I think it's Make America Great Again.
Right. But what these people are really talking about is what I call a pre-Beatle America.
Yes.
You want to go back before the Cultural Revolution that happened in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
This youth-led revolution that occurred. That they spearheaded.
Right. And the backlash.
They ignited, they were the catalyst for
it. And I mean, if you get political, but the backlash really reached its, at the beginning was with Reagan and the attempt to push back things from the 60s,
well, the
including rights,
movement,
including all sorts of rights. And that's why, I'm not going to make a political statement. But anyway, it was dangerous. They were considered a threat.
They were considered a threat, absolutely.
And that just asked Nixon during the 70s with John, which was it was ridiculous because Lenin, they were afraid that Lenin was going to somehow influence the 72 election.
Well, he could have.
Well, probably not.
Well, just to a certain extent.
Yeah, but it was paranoia beyond anything.
Well, there was concern that he was going to go to the convention in Miami.
Right.
Which I think he actually was going to do, but then the plan changed.
Yeah, that's what he said. Yeah, said later. But, it was an overreaction to the power of John Lennon. And even with the vote given to the 18-year-olds, it turned out in that election that they didn't vote that, I believe so, the numbers of 18-year-olds voting in that the first election was pretty low, considering that they had a chance now to have some power. So,
We're not getting off topic at all.
I'm sorry.
Not really.
They were somewhat political
from the get-go. That's the thing.
Subtly political. Well, not.
Well, people talk about revolution as an obviously political song and Give Peace a Chance. But earlier you played Nowhere Man. Mm-hmm. I consider that their first political song.
Sure. I mean, culturally or literary political. You know what I mean? It's not.
Yeah, not obvious.
Vote for me. I'm running for governor or whatever.
Well, if you think about what does political mean? It's about power. It's about power relations, and shifting power relations. Mm-hmm. And Nowhere Man was really a clarion call to this generation. I mean, that's how fans in the book. I have some quotes from fans who talked about their takeaway from Nowhere Man was. Sure. What do you believe? Do you have opinions? What's your place in the world? And think about the big picture.
Open your eyes.
Exactly.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, Hey Jude, A Fool on the Hill, and there's one other one.
The
Word is love. Absolutely. The Word. It very much, help me if you can. I'm feeling down.
Well, it is about
coming together and helping one another and this message of love and positivity.
Yeah. They were asked, I think it was 66, I don't know, somewhere, why don't you write any anti-war songs? Right. And they said, all our songs are anti-war, which is a brilliant answer.
It is a great
It's brilliant
line.
And it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
Right. Prudence, what did Paul McCartney say when a reporter said, some of your songs are about about drug addicts, prostitutes, and lowlifes.
He said, "Well, we're just trying to write songs about drug addicts, prostitutes, and lowlifes."
That's not an exact quote, but it was very clever.
It's on this video of their response. One of their later press conferences in '66 when they said, "Can't buy me love," something. A Ticket to Ride is about a prostitute. And
what do you think about that, Paul? As if he can't write a song like that, and he responded, "Well, we write songs about prostitutes."
Yeah.
Right. Which is pretty amusing.
It was very funny.
Well, also, they were so sick of all these questions. Oh, you can see it in the press conference. They found inane, and they had the gift of banter with the press, and they just,
Yeah, 50 years ago, John Lennon was quoted in saying the Beatles are bigger than Jesus.
I got the direct quote. And you want to hear it?
Then, yeah, we do want to hear it, Prudence, if you want to pull it up.
Okay.
But in the meantime, but it was interesting. When he was questioned on it, he said, made it clear, he said he was not questioning Jesus as a god or a thing.
Yeah.
It was just that their popularity was...
And he was absolutely right.
Well, I got to... You know, I love the Beatles, love Lennon, and all that, but you read the quote, because when I first heard about this controversy, I was just first heard about the Beatles, so I said, all those idiots, they don't understand. But when you think about it, think if the Jonas, somebody of the Jonas Brothers said something like that now that Jesus was dumb. I would think you'd be honest to say, who the hell is Dick Jonas?
Back then,
John Lennon, I would have said, looking back, I'm sorry, I'm excited about this, who the hell is John Lennon to talk about Jesus
the
like
thing
that?
Is,
and
though,
I have the quote if you want to hear it.
In England, it was not questioned. It was only the fundamentalist South that got this notion going that the Beatles were somehow...
No, other countries too. The reason why it wasn't because it was just Lennon talking. And it's not the point of the article, whereas it was just part of the article.
Exactly.
Right, so it's just Lennon talking. But in America, I don't blame... I'm not the people who burn the records. I'm not talking about them, but people to say, hey, wait a second, who the hell is he to say that?
But it's interesting you said that, and I do want to hear the original quote, if you want to say it, only because Lennon made a point to say that he was not putting down Christianity.
Afterward, when he was called out on it.
Right, so we're going to hear we're going to hear the original quote, and I do have one more thought I'll say after this. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that John was a great guy and all that, but one of his negative quotes, he could be a pretty arrogant guy and flippant about a lot of things.
Here's a quote by John Lennon, read by Prudence.
Well, this is from How Does a Beatle Live? John Lennon Lives Like This, from the London Evening Standard, March 4th, 1966. And the paragraph begins, "Experience has sown few seeds of doubt in him. Not that his mind is closed, but it's closed around whatever he believes at the time. Christianity will go, he said. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right, and I will prove not that what he read," because he referred it later to explain it, "that he read about this." He said, "I am right, and I will be." Is that not arrogant? And prove it. We're more popular than Jesus now. Really now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. Okay. It's them twisting it that ruins for me. Now, you listen to that earlier. I mean, you listen to that statement, and you don't tell me that, wow, that's arrogant.
Well, it's
arrogant. I love the guy.
It's arrogant, and it's a wrong prediction, but it's not him putting down Jesus.
Wait a second. You only... I'm sorry. I'm getting all excited about that.
But I'm just saying.
What do you say, Candy,
He's
author of
Beatleness? I'll tell you what young fans thought at the time. A very young female fan, born in 1961, recalled people talking about the comment. "I thought, wow, someone famous thinks they're more popular than God? That was fascinating to a child." One church-going female fan, born in 45, recalls her minister talking about it. He said the Beatles were a bad influence. As she saw it, they were just free spirits who made you feel free and more like yourself. Another fan, born in 49, remembers visiting family in Arkansas that summer who called Lennon low-life scum. But she thought what he said made sense. Quote, "If you asked young people, would you rather go to church or a musical event, what would they say? Come on, there's no question." Another fan had a similar reaction. Quote, "Some of my girlfriends didn't like it, but what he said was true. Would you stand in line for 2 days to take communion? Of course not. But you'd stand in line for 3 days to see them."
Words by Candy Leonard.
When I was a kid going to church, before I became a lapsed Catholic, I would fall asleep in church. So, of course, I'd rather listen to a Beatles album before I even know there was a Beatles.
Let me go on. Though the reactionary record burnings may have been more about publicity for the radio stations than genuine outrage at what Lennon said, reaction to the comment speaks to its truth. right? I mean,
well, but listen to that comment before John explained what he was talking about. He doesn't say, you know, I was concerned about the lack of attendance by young people and that we're pop groups. He doesn't say that. He said it that way. That's what I'm talking about. But, not his explanation. We know, looking back, what he meant.
But Prudence,
and that John was a good intelligent.
He was saying
people.
That young people are more into pop music than,
right.
than religion.
That's,
and that's just the fact.
No, I know that. That's what he said. No, I'm saying from that quote, you took that he was talking about his concern. I don't think. Come on, be honest.
From that quote, I took that he made a bad prediction.
No,
and that
you don't,
he did.
Okay.
He made a terrible prediction. And that he was so arrogant about the Beatles that they, you know, in pop music, in terms of what the importance of the Beatles were compared to the importance of religion. And just saying that, I mean, he's just shooting from the hip. He did
which
not.
Which he often did.
Yeah. He often did. And that was completely let go in England. It was only in America that got some reaction.
Because as a couple of fans said, that they wanted to cut, it was an opportunity to knock Lennon and the Beatles down a peg, which it was. They had so much cultural authority at that time with young people. Everything they said and did was scrutinized, and they were a focal point for young people in a way that they were the most interesting thing happening in our lives, with no exception. So
sure.
They had this huge cultural authority with young people, and so this comment was very, very threatening. But the fact that the outrage over it really kind of shows how much power they had. The other thing that should be pointed out is that a couple of months before this, Time magazine had a cover story, Is God Dead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was a very stark red and black graphic cover of Time magazine. Now, of course, in 2016, it's hard to communicate the importance and the significance of that, but it was hugely significant.
Absolutely,
and important.
Yes.
So we're talking about the Vietnam War is raging. The civil rights movement is stalled from the perspective of African Americans.
Right.
There's civil unrest all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we can also talk about Muhammad Ali.
Right, exactly. And the Beatle connection
The Beatle connection, but sure. The climate of that moment.
Right,
okay.
Yeah.
And so you have Lennon's comment, yes, taken out of context and misconstrued. But it was a time when the country was really in turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real sense that things were changing and the establishment, the old guard, was not happy.
Mm-hmm. We have Candy Leonard from Beatleness with us, and we're taking calls 617-627-3800. We'll be back in just a second.
All right, everybody
sorry,
in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
We have Candy Leonard, author of Beatleness, with us. And if you want to be a part of the conversation, call 617-627-3800. We're talking about 50 years ago when John Lennon said that the Beatles were bigger than Elvis.
Hey,
that, folks.
What the hell was that? That Lennon, what a jerk.
Wow, I got that one wrong.
Yeah.
John Lennon said the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. And what does that mean to you? Is he right? Because think about it for folks. Think about it for 1 second, folks. Young people, old people, parents, kids, they'll go and spend tickets. Maybe they'll buy 4 tickets to a rock concert or a pop concert. They'll go see Beyonce. They'll see Jonas Brothers, if they're still around. Justin Bieber or Justin Timberlake or whoever. You name any band. Even, you know, Elton John, perhaps. What are they spending? $150, $200, $300, $400, maybe $500 a ticket. So 4 tickets at $250, that's $1,000. How much money do they give
parking
to
and refreshments?
How much money did they give to their local synagogue or mosque or church? I mean, you tell me, Jim or Prudence, was John wrong? Were the Beatles bigger than Jesus? And are they still? I mean, it's just an interesting thing. What do people focus on? Do they want to see a concert at Fenway Park or the Boston Garden or Foxborough and spend thousands of dollars just for a few tickets, for a few hours? And what do they give / talk about in terms of their religion or their spirituality? What do you think about that concept?
Well, I think he was wrong. There are 7 billion people in the world. And the Catholic Church, heard is the richest institution in the world. So obviously, there are people giving a lot of money to religion. And good people, not just, you know, these fundamentalist idiots, dangerous people. Good people where religion has positively affected their lives, that are strong for it. And so he was wrong. I'm sorry, he was wrong.
Well, in the sense of religion continuing and being a factor in people's lives, absolutely. Right, absolutely. Yeah. But like I said before, people in America today, they'll give more money to pop music than they will give to the church.
Well, I don't know if that's true. Is that true?
I mean, in terms of...
people we know, but yeah.
I wonder if...
Generalizations are usually
if you're a listener
incorrect.
Out there and you don't give more money to pop and entertainment than you to church, I'd like to know about that. Please, Paul. I'm just being frank or / brutally honest.
I'd rather you be Vinny
with the concept in terms of, you know, were the Beatles more popular than Jesus Christ? Candy?
Oh, Candy's
well,
here. Hi, Candy.
I mean, this...
Again, it's a popularity thing. It doesn't mean they're better or bigger.
Christ is a thing, or God is a thing.
Right, exactly.
That must be on YouTube. We could play that.
He was making an observation about really his... You know, the other thing... Well, let me just... Before I go... One of the things with Lennon, and there's a very fascinating interview that he did with Look magazine in December of 66, and I strongly recommend it. You can find it online, Look magazine, December 66. And he was, you can hear in this thing that he was not only kind of tired of being a Beatle, but he was very aware of his power that he had because of being a Beatle, and that people listened to things he said, and he was aware that he was more, that they were more famous than anybody had ever been before. That, and there was a certain, you know, I think it blew his mind in some ways. He didn't know what to make of his own fame and what his role should be. And of course, this is where Yoko really, in a sense, helped him figure this out, because she. Because the anti-war activism that they undertook together was one way of him using his celebrity, to make a difference in the world. But getting back to the Jesus thing, I think that part, you know, is it offhand comment to Maureen Cleave, who was actually his lover at the time.
Yeah.
You know, in the London Evening Standard newspaper. So it was an offhand comment, and he was kind of probably musing out loud how weird it was that they were so popular, and young people are more tuned into them than to Jesus. And I think that 50 years on, like, I can't even believe we're still talking about it.
I couldn't agree with you more because you wrote
a book of how long lasting the Beatles.
She's just commenting on the significance. I think it's blatantly obvious that
if you take it in its context, he was absolutely correct.
Okay, can I just
in my opinion?
Yeah, just to go away from this, but you mentioned that Look magazine interview where he seems restless and everything. The end of the Maureen Cleave interview, this is very interesting. He says, "You see, there's something else I'm going to do, something I must do, only I don't know what it
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
That's why I go around painting and taping and drawing and writing and that, because it may be one of them. All I know is this isn't it for me."
Exactly. Right. And Yoko helped him figure that out.
Yeah. Well, she saved his life.
You know, she encouraged
really
him to explore other types of art, other media. And they both shared this strong anti-war feeling. And she grew up, you know, she was in Japan when the bomb fell.
Oh, yes. Oh, terrible childhood she had.
Right. So they really, you know, there was a connection that they had that I think a lot of people, maybe now people who care, do realize it. But certainly at the time, because she was not your, you know, a blonde, blue-eyed Liverpool or London girl or a London model.
Oh, no.
She was not the what you'd expect the kind of woman a Beatle should be with.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so people
A white man to be with.
Exactly.
You know,
but in terms of helping John to grow as a person and to kind of figure out the exit strategy, she was very helpful.
Yes, and That's true. Can you tell me, what did you think of Yoko at the time you first heard about them together? How old were you, like 11?
Yeah, something like that. I don't really quite remember what I thought, but I do very vividly remember this feeling that this was like a whole other side spectacle now to watch, right?
Yeah.
In parallel to the Beatles, because, you know, they were on TV together, and they were touring together, and there were pictures of them in the newspaper together, and then there was also the Beatles, and so... she seemed unlikely. I remember we used to make fun of her the way she sang. You know, we joked about her singing, and you know. But you know, in retrospect, their attraction and their relationship really makes sense.
Oh yeah, in retrospect, you know?
If I could get back to the quote one more time, I really don't think Lennon was putting down spirituality or Christianity or Jesus. As a person or a thing.
Not as a thing.
Or whatever it is. And yet,
it said television.
And yet, they jumped all over him. And boy, they were about to crucify him.
Well, it was a great excuse to, again, the Beatles, it was a great excuse, as one fan said, to knock him down a peg. And, you know, it wasn't only the established, the media who jumped on that. Look at the history of the Grammy Awards that they got, and when they were nominated, and who won instead of them. Which is another example of how the establishment was very threatened by
them,
because they represented something new in many different arenas.
And just to give you an idea of how words can be taken, and just like, you know, Lennon was not, you know, like I said before, specifically criticizing slash putting down other religion. He was just talking about popularity, about the Beatles. Do you recall what a group said about George W. Bush?
The Dixie Chicks.
Yeah, they said that he was stupid and that he was dumb and he was bad and he was...
They were ashamed to be from Texas.
I think that perhaps is the exact quote. But they said a lot of those things, and basically they ruined their career.
Yeah.
I don't think the Dixie Chicks have ever recovered. And there's a film about it I haven't seen.
Shut Your Mouth and Sing or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
And it talks about how, because of some...
It's a documentary about them. That's not the... Just all the filmmakers felt
because
about them.
They put across that point of view.
Yes,
their career took a severe hit.
And there's aspects of that, because it was country music was just generally conservative, so the reaction to it was, you know, and all that. But anyway,
so we're with Candy Leonard in Beatleness, and we're talking about 1966. And here's a Beatles song. We're going to play a little bit of it. That was a few years after it, but it's still pretty interesting. This is the Beatles on WMFO Medford.
Without going out of my door, I can know all things on earth. Without looking out of my window, I can know the ways of heaven. The farther one travels, the less one knows. The less one really knows. Without going out of your door, you can know all things on earth. Without looking out of your window, you can know the ways of heaven. The farther one travels, the less one knows.
without traveling. See all without looking, do all without doing.
Don't swear, anybody.
The next few minutes are in the lap of the gods and the hands of the Beatles. In my young days, when I was a lad, they used to have actors in films, and now
Hey, listen.
It's all changed now, all Brian.
Well, this is what
they're
I wondered.
They're not doing that. No actors.
In those days, the actors used to say their best bits were left on the cutting room floor. Did you find that?
No. Those were the good bits in the film. You said they're saying the best.
Yes.
Rubbish.
Was it really?
Even worse, yes.
Who was worse?
Oh, Paul.
I see.
I think John was about the worst.
No, it was you.
Oh, Ringo was very good. He's a good lad, yes.
They're saying he's a new Charlie Chaplin. Do you think it's right?
He's an old one. Okay, Ring.
I read over the years that George was always the solid actor when it came to the early two films. Dick Lester or Richard Lester said that out of the four of them, George was the most reliable when he was filming the two films.
I was actually watching Hard Day's Night recently and looking at the extras. I love extras. And they were commenting, there's commentary by some of the people in the film, mm-hmm. including the one who played Shake, the tall guy. And George's scene with the marketing guy, you know, that's a grotty shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
Actors who were commentating said he underplayed it so beautifully. Yeah. It was just a casual
I'll
way.
I'll have
it was
a
beautiful.
Bash.
Yeah, I love that. Oh, that girl that we all say nasty things about when she's
home. Turn the sound down and say rude things about
her. I love it.
Yeah, that's a great scene. That's a great scene.
Yeah, I love underplaying it.
I love in Hard Day's Night when they're drinking beer, they're having a bitter, and they're at a pub, and it's very British. I mean, I'm pretty sure they say the word bitter, and I never heard that
word.
You
mean help?
In the movie, I'm pretty sure it's Hard Day's Night.
The scene where they...
They're having a beer together.
Who, all four?
Yeah.
In a Hard Day's Night?
I believe so.
Don't think there's...
They're in the cafeteria.
It might have been help.
They're in the studio cafeteria with the father, grandfather. The only pub scene is Ringo with when he throws the dart, hits the
right,
bird.
Right, but that's in Help.
No, that's in Heart. That's in a Hard Day's Night. I just saw the movie. Remember when Ringo's alone in the pub and he has the stale bread?
The stale sandwich.
She goes, that was
fresh
this morning.
Fresh this morning, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ben. We got to digress.
No, it's... I just, you know...
But you said it was a very British scene, wherever it was.
It was.
Wherever the movie was in.
Yeah, and I mean...
Well, everything about them was so British. That's one of the things that we loved about them. And everybody became an Anglophile because there was... It was speaking English. It was familiar, but it was... this slightly different culture, and it was
exotic.
Just fascinating.
And
I always like to remind people of is they were changing and growing, but they were authentically themselves.
Yeah.
They were these four northern guys who never veered off from, you know, like left their left. In some ways, they never left Liverpool. I mean, though they went far from Liverpool, if anyone ever did. They always grew. They always changed.
Yeah.
And yet, they were always themselves. I always found that a fascinating angle with the Beatles.
Well, Candy, you must have felt that as a kid, and other fans noticed that they were authentic. Whatever, even when they changed organically.
Right. I mean,
organically.
And again, we didn't really think of it that but you're absolutely right, and that was part of why they were so lovable.
Sure. I think so
because there was no artifice there.
Right. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
This is who they were, you know, and you could tell. It's certainly when they're off stage. In fact, even in that Look magazine interview I referred to, he does talk about how they have to kind of they can't fully be authentic.
But
there
their
was
image, they had an image,
right?
Yeah.
But there was this sense that these were real people who were having fun doing what they were doing
and wanted to do it, and the things they said,
And with authentic, quality,
They didn't lie. They didn't appear to be lying.
Well, it was a great Liverpool tradition / you had to be able to take a joke. You had to be able to laugh at yourself.
Oh, definitely.
The self-deprecating.
And they did
humor.
That quite a bit. And we'll see if John does it here.
The British Theatre, it only holds 2,000, the maximum. That's the largest. They're like the old music hall things that you don't even have over here. You know, the real old, these theatres were built years ago, or even cinemas we play. It's like going around all the cinemas. You know, there's nothing like 20,000 crowds. The only time you get that is for football.
How do you feel about the reaction of the of teenage America, young America, to your music, and the way they show their appreciation of the Beatle music by their screaming and their shrieking and their cheering?
Especially
when you're performing. This is what I mean. You know, you can hardly. The predominant sound, of course, is the enthusiasm from the audience. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we played for about 4 or 5 years, being completely heard. You know, and it was good fun, and it's just as good fun to play being not heard and being more popular.
As good fun, John called it.
But of course, we know that towards the end, they didn't like touring anymore for many reasons. One of which was that
they couldn't hear themselves.
Nobody could hear them anyway, and they couldn't hear themselves, and that they weren't getting better.
They were getting worse.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in a sense of
live.
Their stage production and their
because they heard tapes and they go, oh my god.
And also the logistics, the security. It was too much.
I think it was more of a mechanical not getting better or not improving.
They couldn't hear themselves.
They literally could not hear sound.
They were bored with the whole thing because they were only playing 20 minutes of songs that they recorded 3 years before. They couldn't play, I don't think they played
any
Revolver
songs.
They
were bored and they wanted to get into the studio and, you know, I mean, Rubber Soul had already come out by then. They were working on Revolver by then. So they wanted to go into the studio and explore new sounds and try to replicate their drug experiences in sound, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have the equipment to, you know, I mean, many years later,
yeah,
Beatlemania,
yeah.
You know, they have tape loops. They have, you know, gigantic amplifiers.
They couldn't reproduce the stuff on the stage.
Right.
It was really
the brilliance of having the album Sgt. Pepper go out on tour and their later works go out on tour for them.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think in some ways it added to the mystique. I think fans would have kind of like, okay, we had these people on the Smothers Brothers show, Ed Sullivan, of course, and on the news often performing live, you know, little clips of them.
Right.
But now they're not doing that. You have to hear the album. You have to hear the single. What was that like, Candy?
Well, when they stopped touring, people were very disappointed because they would never get to, you know, as far as anybody knew, and it turned out to be, in fact, the case, that they'd never get to see them live again. And, but, I mean, more devastating than that they stopped touring was, of course, when they broke up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was really difficult for fans because here they'd been this constant presence for 6 years, day in and day out. You know, as one fan said, you wake up, you brush your teeth, you listen to the Beatles, you know, and suddenly they're not there anymore. And it was like somebody who visited you regularly and reliably brought you joy and pleasure and stuff to talk about with your friends and all this. Like, suddenly this isn't going to be happening anymore.
Was it like four lovable uncles who come back from their trips and say, this is what I saw and look at this?
Kind of. I mean,
but they were very intelligent and very fascinating.
I don't know about your uncle, but mine's pretty
Well, that's the thing. Like, there's no word for it. Like, people, like, search for a word. It was sort of like uncles or cousins or big brothers. Or friends, or teachers, or you know, there was no word to describe the role that they played in fans' lives. There really is no word for it, which is why, I mean, Beatleness, you know.
That's why people need to read your book,
right,
Candy?
What book is that?
I think what my book, you know, I mean, and I tried to do this, and I just based on the comments that I've received, I think I succeeded.
Yeah.
Which is to really capture what it was like, not only in the very early days of Beatlemania, but how some version of the mania really continued until the very end, until 1970, and also how it became intertwined with all the events that were happening in the country at the time, the war, you know, of course, the drugs, the hippie movement, the assassinations, you know, all of it. The Democratic Convention in 1968, when Revolution and Hey Jude 45 had just come out. So all of these events, you know, kind of there was a dynamic between the Beatles output, the things that were happening in the country, and this huge generation processing all
right.
of this.
Yes. You know. And some commentators have mentioned it was appropriate that the Beatles broke up at the end of the 60s or 70s because they were of the 60s. That, you know, I don't know how you feel about that. In retrospect,
well, I think,
not the time.
I think that certainly in looking back on it, yes, it's very tidy how at the end of, halfway through May of 70, they broke up. I think at the time, I don't know that we felt that way because there was this need for them. Don't forget, this was... The announcement that Paul quit the Beatles, which was interpreted as Beatles broke up, so that was April 10th, right?
Yeah.
And then a few weeks later is the Kent State murder.
May 4th.
May 4th. So there was this sense that, and I have a quote, a fan captured this in a couple of quotes in the book, that this sense of we're on our own now, that they're gone, and the... You know, I mean, Kent State was a very big deal.
I imagine, yeah.
And it was very much a turning point.
Sure. Was that April of 1970?
May 4th, 1970.
Was Kent State.
The announcement of the Beatles breaking up, 1970,
yes.
April. Okay,
April
70, So in some odd way, they slightly got into the 70s then.
But it's interesting you say, finally on our own. That's from Ohio, Neil Young wrote that. We're finally on our own. And somebody said, there was there's always people trying to figure out, when was the end of the 60s? Not necessarily December 31st, 1969. Some people claim it was when Nixon was elected.
Well, I
or all that. What do you?
If you ask me to define the 60s,
yes, there, first
I
you
would
have to
define
do that.
The 60s as August 63.
Mm hmm.
To August 74.
Why, Candy?
August 63 was the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech.
Oh, yes.
And August 74, of course, was the resignation of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
So that period I consider to be the 60s, as we think of the
60s. Yeah, as you think of it,
You know, I would say that I would bring it up through 1974.
Well, I've never heard that. I mean, I've heard other dates and reasons, but I've never heard that.
Well, what's interesting,
that's why we have Candy on every year.
it's a little bit about how, you know, the Beatles, they reflected what was going on around them, and they influenced what was going on around them.
And
the Beatles were a product of the 60s is really off. It's very, you know, not quite accurate, and it's not because they were the 60s.
Yeah,
they were a product of the early 60s of their.
I mean, in the sense of like being a fan of Buddy Holly, absolutely. They loved Elvis. They loved Chubby Checker. You know,
I don't know about Chubby
they
Checker.
They certainly
Fast Domino.
They loved Chubby Checker. They actually played the twist.
Heard.
They played the twist constantly when they were in Hamburg.
Oh, I didn't know.
And
that.
Pete Best would sing the twist.
Really?
Absolutely.
Ooh.
You got to read your Mark Lewison book again, Jim.
The 3,000 page book that goes on for 10 pages about the contract with Brian.
You know, they love Larry Williams. They love
Larry Williams. Yeah, not Chubby Checker. I mean,
well, they covered both them.
No, I know. I'm just saying Larry Williams more.
And again, they. You know, you can't imagine the 60s without the Beatles.
Right. Yeah.
So you can. In fact, if you Google the 60s, their picture comes up. I mean, literally. I mean,
and Ali, probably a picture of Ali punching them.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's like saying, can you imagine boxing without talking about Muhammad Ali?
Right.
You can't.
Yeah. Right.
Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, basketball without Michael Jordan. I mean, no such thing.
Right.
I mean,
when we're talking just about like the mystical thing about the Beatles, talking earlier, isn't it odd? You know, Candy was scheduled to be on this long before Muhammad Ali died yesterday.
It is a bit odd, yes.
And when they first came to America, which some people believe was the start of the 60s too, was when they went down. And there's an interesting story about the sports writer brought them.
How they got to
Miami because they were doing Ed Sullivan. I'm sorry, you want to go, Vin?
No, he was going to talk. He was going to fight the bear at that time.
Yeah, Sonny Liston. That's and he was training in Miami. That's where the fight was. And no, that's not where the fight was. That's where... he was training, and the Beatles went down to Miami to do the second Ed Sullivan show, and this sports writer, Robert Lipsight, was like 25, 26. He told Ali's people, you know, why don't you come over? That would be great. You know, the two big stories. They said, Ali, Cassius Clay at the time, really didn't know. He might have heard their name, but he didn't care. And so they had heard of him. So they came in, and he had stepped out or something. So they were actually waiting for him, and Ringo was quoted as saying, where the bleep is Clay?
Yeah.
No, they weren't. But then Clay comes, and they're joking around, and it's funny, and he says things, and he has that picture where he punched one of them, and then the last one gets... And
that picture was being flashed all over over the news this morning.
Yeah, yeah, and so they did that, and everybody laughed and everything. And so as apparently when they left, and Lennon was ticked off, he said, that guy humiliated us. He said, oh, well, Liston's going to kill him anyway.
Right, right.
Everybody thought Liston was going to kill him.
Somebody eulogizing Muhammad Ali this morning and his cultural impact referred to him as, I mean, I want to get this right. It was Dylan with a right hook and the Beatles with boxing gloves.
That's great.
That's great.
I thought it was really good.
We're wrapping up the program. If you want, last minute call, 617-627-3800 if you want to call in. Candy, question for you. What would you think about waking up 1969 and hearing music on top of the Apple Studio?
Oh,
or is it Apple?
Apple Studios, yeah.
Is DMI?
No, it's no, Apple Studios.
It was the Apple offices. The Apple offices.
The studio was in the basement, yeah.
How would you like to experience that day right now? Just for a moment or 2 hours,
perhaps.
I think
it'd be pretty amazing.
And you know what I would think? And again, this is kind of what we've talked about many times. You lived it, and I listened to it and watched it after the fact. I would love to put Let It Be the movie together. It would be a fantasy. I would love to be able to be the editor of the new Let It Be. So if Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney are listening, my name is Vin Magazzini, and this is Acoustic Sailing, and I will edit your movie Let It Be. What do you think about the final images of the Beatles?
I don't think Paul wants Let It Be to be out, because it's not a flattering look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not legacy enhancing.
No,
in
it's
any
not. It's
way.
Painful, but and it's personally painful.
Well, right, but it is very. It's where they were at that time. And the other interesting thing about Let It Be, just want to say, you know, when that hit the movie theaters in mid-May of 1970, this is already a week or two after Kent State.
Mm-hmm.
Along a Winding Road is number one on the charts. Beatles are broken up. And people are blaming Yoko, right?
Mm.
And if you look at Let It, you know, again, just based on what fans knew at the time, of course they're going to blame Yoko, because you look at the film Let It Be, and she's in every scene, and she's intrusive. And why is she there? And don't forget, we're used to 7 years, you know, 6 years of Beatle iconography of four people.
Men.
Suddenly,
four men. Yeah.
Why is she here? You
right.
know,
right, yeah.
And so that Let It Be. I mean, just this is a little bit of an aside. What I was saying about how I don't think Paul would want it to be out, but just it Let It Be contributed to that feeling of to the Yoko haters. I think.
I think you're right about that, but I also think that I would be able to put it together, assemble it in a way that would be pleasing to the right. masses and
Paul,
pleasing to
Paul
Sir
Ringo.
Paul
You know,
McCartney.
I talk about Let It Be, and I mean, there's that scene, the, it was a video, I think, that played on Ed Sullivan or the Smothers Brothers, one of the words of the two of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can see the tension between the
Absolutely,
between
yes.
them. They're not even, they're as far apart in the frame as they could possibly be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't remember that. I remember them at the same microphone.
No, there's two of us, and one of them is a rock one where they're together, and the other one they're far apart.
Okay.
I mean, fans, you know, didn't. I mean, now of course people want to see Let It Be, but at the time it did not.
It was a bummer?
It was kind of a bummer. Yeah, it was kind of a bummer because, you know, again, part of the appeal was the joy, the fun, and especially for boys who are at this point been watching them for, you know, 6 years, so they become teenagers now. I mean, the camaraderie between them was very, very appealing
to boys and young men. That is absent in the film, Let It Be.
Absolutely gone.
Right.
And so you see these guys who you used to love watching them on the screen, these four best friends.
Right.
And so it was very painful to watch.
It was. And at the time, obviously, you didn't have, back in the 90s weren't around, and they didn't have tea again and make Free as a Bird and kind of patch things over this amazing ride. It's been an amazing ride. It's 1 minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you, Candy Leonard. It was great 2 hours talking about the Beatles.
Thank you.
Candy's the author of Beatleness. Get her book. You'll love it. It's Candy Leonard, the fan's eye view of the Beatles' Beatleness. And Prudence, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Vin. Anytime, Candy.
Thank you.
And here are the Beatles. This is WMFO Medford.
Oh, thank you.
When I came in, he said, do you want to be Jim the Walrus?
Jim the Walrus.
So I was thinking, okay, what? Prudence, because that's my favorite
Walrus song. Is Jim.
Yeah, that's a great. And John, Paul plays Crimson.